to look at a new study on the relationship between football and brain injuries. First, it was just announced this afternoon that White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci is out. Scaramucci just stepped into that role 11 days ago. This is the latest high-profile departure from President Trump's administration. On Friday afternoon, the president announced General John F. Kelly as the new White House Chief of Staff on Twitter. Kelly has been serving as the Secretary of Homeland Security. The tweet effectively dismissed then White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus of Wisconsin. Here's a clip of Priebus from an interview he did Friday night on CNN. His first interview since his departure from the White House was announced.
The president has a right to change directions. The president has a right to hit a reset button. I think it's a good time to hit the reset button. I think he was right to hit the reset button. And I think that it was something that I think the White House needs. I think it's healthy. And I support him in it.
Molly Ball joins us now. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers U.S. politics. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
And we just heard a clip of Reince Priebus sounding not like someone who's just been quickly dismissed from the White House, a job he hadn't held for a terribly long period of time. His tenor seems as though he's in understanding with the president. What do you make of that clip, his tone?
Yeah, and I also spoke to Reince Priebus yesterday, and it was very similar. He praises the president. He says he was not fired, actually. He says that he resigned, although we didn't find out about it until the president announced in a tweet that he had been replaced. But he is clearly still on the team, at least conceptually. He still sees himself as a supporter of the president. He praises the things that have been accomplished, both by him when he was chief of staff and under this administration. There is some speculation that he is potentially angling for some kind of position still connected to the White House. He hasn't decided what he's going to do next.
And Priebus, they're saying the president has a right to hit the reset button, and it looks as though the president hit the reset button again, because now Anthony Scaramucci has also been let go or resigned from the position of director of communications. What do you think happened today? Why is Scaramucci gone?
Well, we're still sifting through what happened here because it did just happen. But it does seem like, the official line from the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, this afternoon was that the president viewed Anthony Scaramucci's comments last week to The New Yorker, the infamous tirade about the other White House staffers, that the president viewed that as inappropriate. He didn't like the vulgarity therein. Of course, the reporting from inside the White House is that actually the president enjoyed that little tirade. And we've certainly heard this president engage in similar language himself. So that appears to be sort of the cover story. But the symbolism of it certainly is the assertion of authority by the new chief of staff, John Kelly. General Kelly was the director of the Department of Homeland Security. He came in on the condition that he would have a certain level of authority that Reince Priebus never really had, the authority to hire and fire people and have the staff actually report to him, not always going around him to the president. Scaramucci hadn't even officially started in his White House position, but Kelly viewed him as a troublemaker, and it was Kelly's decision to clean house and to get a fresh start.
So we know at this point that it was General Kelly's decision.
That's what we've been told. I mean, nothing is ever certain in this sort of hall of mirrors of this White House. But yes, this is being described as General Kelly's decision and his move to get a, quote, fresh start.
It's interesting because that echoes the language of Reince Priebus, who said the president had a right to hit the reset button. And then this afternoon we had White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders releasing a statement saying Mr. Scaramucci felt it was best to give Chief of Staff John Kelly a clean slate and the ability to build his own team. So does that seem to indicate that there could be more big changes coming?
It's possible, and there are certainly rumblings. I mean, there is still now an open communications director position, for example. There's also an opening at the Department of Homeland Security. There's the continuing drama between Trump and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. There's the continuing drama of the rumblings surrounding the special counsel, Robert Mueller. And it is possible to take a step back from the events of the last several days and see it as part of a single shakeup, one that has been in the works talks really for quite a while. If you go back a week and a half to the dismissal of Sean Spicer, it's possible this is one sort of slow motion shakeup and all the pieces are still falling into place. And we haven't yet seen the end of it. Certainly the hope of the White House and its allies and the Republicans in Congress, they are hoping that once the pieces do fall into place, the result will be greater discipline and a more effective operation.
And earlier today, President Trump tweeted that there is no White House chaos as he sees it. What do you make of that statement coming from the president in the midst of the health care failure and these high profile shakeups on his staff?
I think anyone who reports on this White House would say it's just factually untrue. And the president, you know, obviously likes to create his own reality. But it is an objective fact that this White House has been highly chaotic. There has been a lot of drama. There has been a staff that is in turmoil and constantly leaking and constantly internally competitive and constantly unsure of their own positions. And you know, the president doing things like making the order on transgender soldiers last week without even telling the Pentagon. That's a pretty chaotic way to operate. So I don't think anyone who is engaged with this White House on a day-to-day basis would agree with the statement that there's no chaos.
Now, the position of White House Communications Director, that's an important position, as is obviously Chief of Staff. But do we have any idea who might be stepping into that role now that Scaramucci is gone?
We don't have any idea. And this is a position that's actually been vacant for most of Trump's presidency. If you remember all the way back during the transition, this position was given to Jason Miller, who was a veteran of the campaign, very well liked within the veterans of the Trump campaign, but withdrew his name for personal reasons. And then there was no White House communications director for a long time, or perhaps Sean Spicer was technically both communications director and press secretary, which was a very difficult arrangement, certainly hard on Sean. And then a communications director who nobody knew much about, Mike Dubke, was named, and he was completely behind the scenes, almost never made a public statement, didn't appear on television, didn't put his name on press releases. It was hard to see what his role really was. And from what we've heard, he just never really became a part of the operation, and he eventually sort of left without a trace. And Scaramucci, meanwhile, has been in the background this whole time. He's close to Trump. He wants a position in the White House. He at first was supposed to get the public liaison position, but then had trouble unloading his investment firm. And so he was offered various things. He was given a position at the Export-Import Bank. And so he was someone who'd just been sort of circling the White House. And from what we understand, one of the rumors going around is that Jared and Ivanka behind the scenes were sort of using Scaramucci as an instrument to push out Reince. The palace intrigue is sort of constant, and you never know what to believe about this White House. But that is one of the things that we're hearing. And so that work was kind of accomplished.
Does the fact, do you think, that Scaramucci has been ousted or has resigned, does that indicate to you that President Trump might be more willing to work with his new chief of staff, maybe even be more malleable?
Well, yes and no. I would say on the one hand, the Trump-Priebus relationship was always troubled, and Trump does not have the same history with General Kelly. General Kelly at this point seems to be someone he respects and does not have any bad blood with, in fact, greatly respects the job that General Kelly has done at Homeland Security, where one of the signature accomplishments of this White House so far is the dramatic decrease in the number of border crossings on the southern border. And that falls under the Homeland Security purview. So in the sense that General Kelly starts out on a better page with the president, and he's taken this forceful action immediately, suggests that he may, in fact, be able to do better. On the other hand, all you have to do is look at someone like Jeff Sessions to realize you can be as loyal as is humanly possible to Donald Trump, and he can still turn on you. He can still decide that you're no longer in his good graces. Loyalty with Donald Trump is absolutely a one-way street, and it's something that many, many people who've worked for him have found out the hard way.
We're talking with Molly Ball right now, staff writer for The Atlantic, now talking about the ouster of Reince Priebus as White House Chief of Staff, and also Anthony Scaramucci, who now has departed as Communications Director. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this news from the White House? How do you think these staffing changes will affect the politics in Washington, D.C., and the policy that may come out of it? You can call 800-642-1234 and share your thoughts, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking to Molly Ball now from The Atlantic about breaking news that White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci is out just 10 days after he started that new job. And we're also speaking now about Reince Priebus and how he has exited the White House as Chief of Staff, looking at his political career, including his time in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these departures from the White House? Do you hope that former White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus becomes an active participant in Wisconsin politics again? And why do you think President Trump is shaking up his staff so greatly in the past few days? And do you think that could change with General Kelly as the new White House Chief of Staff? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Molly, we switch gears now and focus on Reince Priebus. Now, no other White House Chief of Staff has been forced out after such a short time. Why do you think that it happened this way with Reince Priebus?
Well, as I was talking about before, he always had a bit of bad blood with Trump, going back to his tenure as the Republican National Committee chairman. And I have known Reince since he first ran for RNC chairman way back in 2011, when he was the chair of the Wisconsin Republican Party and the general counsel to the RNC. And he was someone who always viewed himself as a sort of loyal soldier for the Republican Party, and who came under a whole lot of pressure in 2016 when, on the one hand, Trump put him under a lot of pressure, believing he was being treated unfairly. And on the other hand, a lot of the other candidates and other Republicans believed that he was too compliant to Trump in sort of allowing this outsider to come in and effectively take over the party despite not being a traditional Republican. And so he, you know, to his allies, he was someone who had sort of made the best of a difficult situation. But behind the scenes, he did cringe at a lot of the things that Trump would do or say. And in fact, when the Access Hollywood tape came out in October, he suggested to Trump that he might have to drop out of the race. And Trump never forgave him for that. Trump viewed Reince as someone who was weak and someone who was not necessarily loyal to him. So as chief of staff, he was never fully empowered. He never really had the authority. No one ever really believed that he spoke for the president, or that he was that you could take his word as what the president's word, that he had that sort of executive authority that a chief of staff is supposed to have. So it was a very high pressure situation. It was a very difficult tenure for him. And when I spoke to him yesterday, he sounded a bit relieved to be out of that pressure cooker.
One arguably important role that he did serve as White House Chief of Staff was that he was a link to the establishment Republican Party and also to Paul Ryan. And now that's gone.
That's right. And there really are not a lot of traditional Republicans in high profile positions at the White House anymore. I would say that the last one standing is Vice President Mike Pence. Now, there are some staff members who come from, you know, the ranks of the traditional Republican Party, and certainly the agencies are filled with traditional conservatives in the executive branch. But to the extent that this sort of, you know, Game of Thrones in the White House is a larger symbolic wrestling match between different ideologies, different policy visions, Reince had been cast more or less accurately as the voice of the Republican establishment, the voice of conservatives like Paul Ryan, who are interested in advancing advancing conservative policy. And he obviously did remain very close to Paul Ryan. Part of his selling point as a chairman was the whole creation of the conservative infrastructure in Wisconsin that helped Paul Ryan and Scott Walker become stars in the National Party. So a lot of people are wondering whether now that Priebus is not there, Trump will turn more to some of the populist instincts that he displayed during the campaign, the sort of Breitbart-style populist nationalism of a Steve Bannon, or the more sort of moderate liberal vision of a Gary Cohn or of Jared and Ivanka. I think there's no telling. I think that Trump has never articulated a clear policy vision since he's been president. He's never said, you know, here's the road I want to go down in terms of the things he wants to do. But that's certainly a possibility with Priebus out.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Denny with us in Manitowoc. Denny, hi.
Hi. This whole thing is interfering with national security, with people in, out, and whatever, especially removing or moving the head of the Homeland Security Agency without anybody lined up to replace him.
Denny, thanks for that. Is there a vulnerability there, leaving the country for the time being without an acting or a head of Homeland Security?
You know, one of the really remarkable parts of this episode is that the Department of Homeland Security was not notified when this decision was made that they were about to lose their boss. And so when reporters asked who's the acting secretary, the department literally did not have an answer on Friday. And so, you know, I am not an expert on what does or doesn't put national security at risk, but I think it's part of a larger pattern where so many of these executive agencies have not been fully staffed, have not even had people nominated to the positions that need to be confirmed by the Senate. And so we hear lots of stories of different agencies, from the State Department to the Energy Department, which of course guards America's nuclear weapons, just not having enough people to actually run the place on a day-to-day basis. And that is really hurting the functioning of government.
Now, Molly, going back to the Reince-Priebus story, you talked to him. And he said he thought he won. He said, look, there's a Republican in the White House. We have Republicans in both branches of the legislature. We have a conservative appointee on the Supreme Court. Is that how his work and his time is being perceived? Do people see him as a winner in Washington?
I wouldn't say they perceive him as an immediate winner because he was just ousted. But we were reflecting, I think, more broadly on his entire career in national politics, starting with his election to the chairmanship of the Republican National Committee when, you know, back in 2011, the Republicans had just won the midterm elections on the strength of the Tea Party, but they were very much in disarray. There were these warring factions and doubts about whether they could they had what it took to win presidential elections particularly, and the party was deeply in debt, deeply disorganized at the sort of management level. And so he said that he could fix it, and he said that conservatives could come together and could find a way to win without having to compromise their principles. And so in his view, his whole job as RNC chairman was to make the Republican Party win again. And just by the numbers, that is what happened. There are, as he pointed out, there are historic numbers of Republicans in all branches of government down to the state legislative level, the largest number since 1928. Now, you might point out that what happened after 1928 was not particularly good for the Republican Party. But numerically, that's the case he's making.
Now, you talked to Charlie Sykes, former conservative talk show host in Wisconsin, now an MSNBC commentator. What did he have to say as someone who was a never-Trumper? What did he say about the ouster of Reince-Priebus?
Well, and Charlie, people probably know, Charlie and Reince have been friends for a long time, came from the same conservative milieu in Wisconsin, but took different, sharply divergent paths in 2016, where Charlie Sykes was horrified by Trump and became a never-Trumper and actually gave up his popular Milwaukee radio show rather than continue in a party that he thought had been corrupted. Whereas Priebus, you know, fell into line and became a loyal soldier for a party headed by Trump. And so in Charlie Sykes' view and the view of the sort of never-Trump conservatives, Priebus sold out the party. They believe that he took the Republican Party and gave it away to someone who was absolutely lacking in conservative principles, and that there was much more he could have done to stand up to Trump. They believe that he didn't do enough during the campaign to punish Trump for various things that he did that should have been considered unacceptable. You know, very early on, the RNC expressed disapproval of then-candidate Trump's comments about John McCain, but after that, as he continued to spew those kinds of insults, the party sort of never uttered a peep. There are various complaints about the way debates and other things were handled. But the upshot for someone like Charlie Sykes is that Reince Priebus basically made his bed and now he has to lie in it because, you know, he knew what he was getting into. What Charlie said to me is, you know, I feel bad for the guy, but it's not like he wasn't warned.
And Molly, as we wrap up, just a few seconds left, what are you going to be watching for to be seeing what direction the Trump White House takes next now that we've had these big staff changes?
Well, I think everyone wants to know if anything's going to change. I have never wanted to predict that anything is going to change in Trump's orbit just because his patterns are so consistent. And I'm not going to hold my breath waiting for him to suddenly start acting, quote unquote, presidential, because I've watched people predict that for the last 2 years. And he just continues to be the person that he is. But there is certainly a lot of hope, particularly Republicans on Capitol Hill who've been so frustrated by what they see as a missed opportunity to advance conservative policies. They are really hoping that something turns around or that some discipline is imposed just so they can have a little bit more order and less distraction.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Molly Ball, staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers U.S. politics, with us there to talk about news that Anthony Scaramucci is out as White House communications director. And we also talked about President Trump's removal of Wisconsin's Reince Priebus as White House chief of staff. You'll find a link to Molly's piece about the political career of Priebus on the Central Time Facebook page. First, as we approach the end of summer, more and more school football programs are getting underway. But as the new season looms, so does the ever-growing specter of brain injuries. And a new study paints a grimmer picture for those who play the game. Researchers at Boston University recently examined the donated brains of over 200 deceased football players, from those who played in high school all the way to those who played in the NFL, and found that the vast majority of them did in fact have CTE. CTE is a neurodegenerative brain disease, which can be found in people who have been exposed to repeated head trauma. To narrow it down even further, the disease was identified in the brains of 110 out of 111 former NFL players. But does that mean that CTE is a given the longer you play football? Lingering questions remain. Dr. Halle Zweibel joins us now. He's assistant professor and director of the Center for Sports Medicine at the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Zweibel, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we just heard some of the numbers there, but in your words, how prevalent is CTE in the brains of former football players?
Well, so the interesting thing about the study, which you mentioned, is that CTE was very prevalent among the sample they selected from this brain bank. The caveat comes in, and the researchers were definitely mentioning this in their article, was that these brains were all from players who and their families who were concerned enough to have their brains donated to this brain bank. So although this study shows that CTE is a risk from football, it doesn't tell us the degree of risk.
And what is your reaction to these findings? Again, looking at those NFL numbers, 110 out of 111 of these brains of former football players were found to have CTE. What do you think about that?
Well, having first read it, it's definitely an alarming statistic. But as you delve further into the article, you have to realize that the selection of people are families and individuals who are concerned enough to have their loved ones' brains donated for further study. So it's hard to tell how indicative this is of the larger football, how indicative it is of the larger issue in football from this sample.
I want to back up a minute and talk specifically about CTE. Can you tell us what it is, what it does?
Sure. So as you said, CTE stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And chronic traumatic encephalopathy really categorizes a few different dysfunctions we can notice. It can be cognitive issues, so people can have lapses in memory, reaction time processing. It can be behavioral issues where they might get angrier easier or have issues with depression or anxiety. Or in certain groups, it could be movement issues such as Parkinson's-like problems. And we understand why CTE is occurring. So I like to think of it like a conveyor belt. Between the nerves and the brain, there's pieces of information and chemicals passing through. And when there's a blow to the head, those conveyor belts, those pieces of information can get disrupted, and they can accumulate. And over time, we believe that's what causes this neurodegeneration.
So is science able to say right now that there is a link between head trauma, repeated head trauma, and CTE?
Science can say that there is a link, but we, again, don't know how much of a link. We don't know how much head trauma, the type of head trauma, and when it occurs. We can't tell if that is related to if you will have CTE. We just don't know yet.
One interesting thing that the study seems to have found is that brains that exhibited a mild form of CTE, the symptoms that were reported were things like mood swings, some of the erratic behavior you were talking about. And for severe signs of CTE in the brain, what was seen then was a memory loss. So it seems as though there was a broad spectrum of impact on the individual and what the brain looked like.
Right. So if you read the article in depth, it actually says that in a lot of these people, it started out as behavioral issues. But in a few people, it also started out as cognitive or even both. But no matter how it started out, CTE was progressive in all the different groups. The main difference, I would say, and what the researchers found, was that individuals with mild CTE were more likely to commit suicide, while individuals who had some more severe CTE usually passed on from complications from issues like dementia and Parkinson's-like problems.
Right now, we're talking with Dr. Hallie Zweibel of the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine, and we're looking at concussion, CTE, and the latest research on football and brain injuries. A new study found CTE in 99% of deceased NFL players' brains, and our guest points out that those were brains that were donated from concerned families, so there could be a link there or some kind of bias in the study, but still interesting news. And looking at how long the knowledge has been around, what do we know, Dr. Zweibel, about how long the medical community has known about CTE?
Well, it hasn't been very long. It was actually first identified by Dr. Bennett Amalu, who, if you know his story, it's really interesting. He was a Pittsburgh medical examiner, and a former NFL player came across his examination table, and he noticed that the brain didn't look like ones he was familiar with. So he did the pathology, he did the studies, and he saw that these changes were consistent with something he termed CTE, and that's where we've kind of sprung from, and all the research has come from that point.
And as it stands, it seems like CTE is something that can only be diagnosed after you die. Is this something that could change in the future?
Exactly. So at this point in time, CTE only can be diagnosed when you die. But researchers and studies like this are helping the scientific community to come up with ways that we can identify symptoms and signs while someone is living to give them the diagnosis.
Now, I want to ask you about something from the news. Just 2 days after the release of this study, the NFL saw a high-profile retirement when Baltimore Ravens linebacker John Urschel announced that he's going to give up football at the age of 26, having only played three seasons in the NFL. He's saying he's going to go on and pursue a doctorate in math at MIT. And he didn't specifically mention that the CTE study was a cause in that decision, but it has been speculated that it did play a role in that decision. Wondering if you think that more and more young players will make similar decisions, maybe not go into football at all.
Well, I think that there really is a concern, and studies like this point out and highlight that there absolutely is a concern with football and CTE. The issue is we really don't know the strength of that concern, how worried individuals should be. We just don't have that knowledge yet. But it is a good idea to raise awareness about concussions and CTE because there are things that can be done if someone does suffer a concussion. And I think the more we raise awareness around concussions, dispel myths, and promote rehabilitation when someone gets injured, that really will go a long way.
Let's take one caller now. We've got John on the line with us in Edgerton. John, hi.
Hello. I was hoping you might help me, point me to some resources that would help me estimate a risk. My son, who's entering his junior year in high school, is just crushed that we won't let him play football. We've held him out for 2 years because in junior high he had two concussions in football. And after that he had one in basketball. So he's had to sit out 2 years. And it's I just don't have any good way of estimating, you know, are we taking a 1 in a million, a 1 in 100, a 1 in 10 chance that he's going to have problems as an adult, brain problems from letting him play high school football.
John, thank you so much for calling in and sharing those concerns. I imagine it's really tough to be a parent in that role. Your kid wants to play, but you want to keep him safe. What do you think, Dr. Zweifel?
Well, John, I think you've asked a very important question and one that a lot of parents are concerned about. And speaking with parents, you know, it's something that comes up very frequently. So in terms of the statistics, 1 in 5 high school athletes will sustain a sports concussion during the season. And like your son experienced, once you have a concussion one time, you're up to 2 times as likely to have a second one. And from there, from 2, you're 4 times as likely to have a third. So it really can be a cumulative issue. Now, when we talk about long-term issues like CTE, we just don't know what that magic number is of how many hits to the head it takes before you are at risk or the type of hits to the head you're taking. We just don't have the answer to the question at this point, and that it's frustrating for us, but it is very frustrating for parents like yourself.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Dr. Zweifel, but if this were your kid, what would you do?
Well, luckily, my daughter's only 10 months old, so I don't have to worry about that as of yet. Mm-hmm. But I have had conversations with many athletes, and I think it has to be a shared decision-making process. I think we have to inform players about the realistic risks of playing sports, but also the benefits, the sociability, the leadership, the athletic integrity that we can gain from sportsmanship. So it is a trade-off, and football comes under the spotlight, but concussion is prevalent in many sports, hockey, rugby, soccer. So although a lot of the headlines are around the NFL, concussion is a problem in many sports.
We're talking right now with Dr. Hallie Zweifel of the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine, looking at the latest research on concussions, CTE, and the latest research on football and brain injuries. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. If you're the parent of a football player, are you concerned about how the game could affect your child's brain health? If you are a football player, are you concerned about what could happen in the future? And do you think football or other contact sports can be made safer? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll continue our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about concussions and CTE with Dr. Hallie Zweibel, assistant professor and director of the Center for Sports Medicine at the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine. And you can join us with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. And let's go right to our phone lines. We've got Dale joining us in De Pere. Dale, hi.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I'm just calling a reference to the fellow just called about his son wanting to play football. Our son had had three prior concussions, two in baseball, one in basketball, in over a spread of years. It was his senior year, and they were looking for players because of injuries, and he begged and pleaded with us. He really wanted to go out in the worst way, and we really never said yes, but he went out. Unfortunately, midway through the season, he fell making a tackle. Hit his head. We had to call our ambulance. Mm-hmm. We had to bring him to the hospital, out of town game. And he has since had another one in a car accident. My feeling is that once they get them, they just seem so much more susceptible to get them a second and third time. And as much as your son wants to play, my gut feeling would be we would not do it again. We would say no, because he's gone through a lot of difficult times. Memory has struggled. A lot of things have happened, and he's still, at this time, he was just hit by a car about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, Mom, I'm so sorry.
So he's going through it again. But it's nothing to take lightly. It's a very serious thing, and I encourage all parents to just play it safe. That's
Dale, thank you so much for calling in response to our first caller, John. And I want to take another call right after that. And again, Dale, I'm sorry that your son had that car accident too, and I hope he recovers quickly. Let's go to Jason now in Iowa County. Jason, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I was just my sons both play football. One's entering his senior year, so that makes 7 years of playing football, and luckily hasn't had any concussions. My other son has been playing for he'll be entering his fourth year of playing football and never had any concussions either. So I'm happy for that. I'm wondering. I have read that perhaps someone who had done some research for the movie about the concussions and that it was maybe said that the type of concussion or the severity perhaps of concussions in youth football and even in college football don't even compare to the concussions that NFL players get.
Interesting question, Jason, and a couple different perspectives there for you, Dr. Zweibel. Dale saying his son got a couple concussions, kept getting them, more susceptible. He says, don't let your son keep playing. And Jason saying his son has been okay. That's been his experience, but he says that maybe the way the concussions impact the brain is different if you're a big NFL player versus a high school player. What do you want to comment on those, Dr. Zweibel?
Yeah, so I think it's important to separate out adolescents and children who are at risk for a concussion versus a professional athlete or an adult who can know the risks going in and make a decision versus a child who is at the discretion of their parents playing. So from my perspective, I think it's really important to highlight the risks to both groups. But I think we really have to be on the safer side when it comes to children and adolescents to make the rules in a way that really promote their safety at all times. So, for instance, the National Soccer Youth Organizations have actually limited heading as part of their game for 13, 14 under girls. And small measures like that can make a difference and hopefully decrease the amount of concussions people have.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Dr. Zweibel, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Hallie Zweibel, assistant professor and director of the Center for Sports Medicine at the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine, joining us there to talk about the latest research on brain injuries and football. One of the challenges of reducing gun violence in Milwaukee is that many of the shooters appear to get away with it. Police say the city is above the national average in the homicide clearance rate, which means an arrest and turning the case over for prosecution. Still, at least one-fifth of the killings in Milwaukee are unsolved this year. Likewise, about two-thirds of non-fatal shootings. Chuck Kornbach has the first installment of a three-part series looking at gun violence.
On June 25th, Imani Robinson was walking to a corner store at 39th and Center Street in Milwaukee. His family says he was caught in a crossfire and hit by a bullet. The 16-year-old died the next day. Robinson's mother, Latasha Davis, has been urging witnesses to come forward.
If anybody know anything, just please come forward and tell MPD. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to inbox me through Facebook or anything like that. The police should be the first ones to know.
MPD, or the Milwaukee Police Department, said last week that it's arrested one of three people who allegedly fired guns outside the store. Davis is urging all the shooters to step up.
Turn yourself in. That's your best bet. Get whatever you got coming. Get it over with. Lord have mercy, you took away somebody's life, my son's life.
Davis spoke at a neighborhood gathering held about 2 weeks after the shooting. The event's message, including on a boombox, was strongly anti-violence.
Violence will only make us weaker. Stop the violence for the sake of
her. Local resident Farina Brooks helped organize the event. She says living in an area with a lot of shootings is difficult, especially when some are unsolved.
You know, I've been here in that same house since like 1990. And so I've seen the community go up and down and bad and worse. And so it's like, you know, okay, I'm tired.
Nationwide, about 60% of murder cases are cleared by arrest or other means. Milwaukee officials say there's been some fluctuation in the local clearance rate, but that this year the number is up to 75 to 80%. Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm says that's still not good enough.
There's never an acceptable clearance rate short of 100%, right?
Chisholm says his office is trying to hold people accountable, but he says in some cases, especially non-fatal shootings, which typically only have a 33% clearance rate, some victims and witnesses may not want to cooperate. He says people are frequently scared, dislike police, or are planning to take revenge. Chisholm also says getting a conviction in a murder trial, which is not part of the clearance rate, can be difficult. So the district attorney says more efforts to prevent violent crime would help police and prosecutors deal with remaining cases. But he says proposed federal budget cuts would weaken prevention. Chisholm has used federal dollars to put staff in neighborhoods to head off violence.
If you take all those resources away, everybody is essentially just chasing their tail all the time. The police are just going from what they would call one hitch to the next hitch to the next hitch. The prosecutors are just doing an assembly line of cases because they have no other choice.
A longtime observer of the criminal justice system agrees that prevention is key. Stan Stojkovic is dean of the School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stojkovic argues the clearance rate is just a measure of police activity. He says it will take community investment and political will to make the streets safer.
What do the schools look like? What do the families look like? What's the employment looking like? The places of worship, what's going on with them? That's a better measure than waiting for criminal justice, which tends to be very reactive after someone is shot.
The outcome of budget debates in Washington and Madison may help dictate how much money Milwaukee has to spend on violence reduction. Meanwhile, community activists like Vaughn Mays are urging witnesses to speak to them if there's concern about telling the police.
Because we live here and we're from here, they may feel comfortable telling us things. And again, be proactive in stopping this kind of thing from happening.
Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.